William James and I do stand-up comedy in Moose Jaw. Bob, call me Bob, McGee, booked me to headline for 3 weeks on his comedy club circuit. Bob's tour began with 1 week in Calgary and one in Edmonton, and he promised classy nightclubs and reasonably civilized audiences. The last week, even Bob found it difficult to put a positive spin on this 6 one-night stands in distant outposts of Alberta and Saskatchewan. I'm sorry. I need to make a generalization. When it comes to comedy, Canadians have lowbrow tastes. There, I said it, and I apologize to any Canadians who feel wronged. Generalizations are frequently vicious and always unfair, and I am sorry this one happens to be true. File that for later. Comedy booking agents flap their wings on an interesting, colorful branch of the show business family tree. They provide a vital service and connect performers to show business venues and audiences. These morally flexible individuals imagine the possibilities, accentuate the positive, and when that fails, lie. Bob may have been Canada's finest representative of the comedy booking agent breed. A cigar-smoking, suspender-snapping, balding, middle-aged fat guy with a phone in his hands, a sparkle in his bloodshot eyes, and a smirk on his lips. Bob occasionally lied when the truth served him better, simply to practice his craft. Comedy booking agents generally follow a standard formula. They import talent from out of town. They pay this talent a fixed amount, in my case $1,500 a week, and then stuff these comedians into as many joints and as many time slots as possible. Whether I worked one show in an evening or three, my cut remained the same. Bob, call me Bob, invented another cost-cutting favorite. He bought a comedy condo, which provided visiting comedians with a place to stay and saved Bob boku bucks on hotel bills. This also allowed comedians to cook for themselves and save on restaurant expenses if they wished. Yeah, like that ever happened. Bob purchased his comedy condo in a seedy section of town. Of course, in Canada, they are too enlightened and evolved to have slums. We might call this a depressed neighborhood, populated by citizens with a fertile economic imagination. Almost everyone earned his livings on the fringe of civilization, including me. The comedy condo cluttered the sixth floor of a deteriorating building, several apartments mixed with various fly-by-night enterprises, and the occasional legitimate dental or accounting office to create a counterculture community. On my way to the comedy condo, I shared the elevator with a woman dressed like a hooker and a man dressed like an entry-level lounge singer, and heard the following poignant conversation. She said, "You're a comedian. Tell me a joke." He replied, "You're a stripper. Show me your knockers." That exchange set the table for 3 weeks of culture and class in sunny Alberta. 2 minutes later, still working on the proper amusing response from the stripper, it's a comedian's lot in life to imagine dialogue, I banged on the door of the comedy condo. Bob, call me Bob, opened the door, put out a cigar and a library book, and welcomed me to Canada. When I shook hands with Bob, something instinctively made my left hand reach back and cover my wallet. The front door opened to a narrow hall. There was a doorway on each side of the hall leading into the bedrooms. I caught a glimpse of a disheveled, if not trashed, bedroom as Bob hustled me into the living room. He obviously furnished a joint from garage sales in the Salvation Army. The place may have been a dump, but at least it was a fire trap. Naturally, the fire escape rusted and collapsed, but Bob thoughtfully provided a rope. It's all true. The kitchen featured a sink and refrigerator from the Industrial Revolution. Incongruously, next to the sink stood a gleaming black state-of-the-art stove. Undoubtedly purloined. The stove served an important purpose. I didn't cook, of course, but I preferred not to cook on the best. When I did cook, I used to use the smoke alarm as a timer. The tour of the living room had barely begun. Decor influenced by Motel 6 with a hint of sleaze, when two escapees from the shallow end of the gene pool wandered from the bedrooms and greeted the dawn at 3 p.m. "That's Dave," Bob nodded toward a tall, gangly youth wearing a white shirt and cut-off jeans who flopped on the couch, squinted his eyes, and tossed out a series of epithets. Dave, perhaps 22 years old, may have been a pleasant-looking, earnest, brown-haired, brown-eyed lad in the context of attending college or dating your sister. However, in the context of greeting the dawn, nursing a roaring hangover, Dave looked pinched and dismal. Colin, Bob indicated the shorter version wearing a similar outfit, who landed on the other side of the couch. Colin, a stocky blonde, appeared as hammered and pathetic as Dave. Dave and Colin never acknowledged us. They began this barking conversation with each other, and I stood a few syllables, but none of the sentences. Normally, I speak passable Canadian, but I struggle to follow this Alberta hangover dialect. 12 bloody pints. I understood 3 words from Dave. She struck me with a bleeding check, the first intelligible sentence. After a few more outbursts, I inferred that Dave and Colin were discussing the adventures of the previous evening and comparing notes. "Yes," I screamed, proud of myself for assessing the situation promptly. Dave and Colin eyed me momentarily before returning to last night's postmortem. Bob's comedy circuit promised a nightclub owner's 3 acts. The opening act commanded the least salary and the least status. That would be Dave. The feature act did a longer set than the opening comic and earned more money. That would be Colin. The headliner performed twice as long as the feature act and delighted the crowd and received the biggest laughs and brought home $1,500 per week. That would be Carl Grant, the hero of this narrative, the big star. For the first 2 weeks, we played respectable clubs in Calgary and Edmonton. Dave opened the show by yelling at the audience and making sure everyone stayed awake and consumed alcoholic beverages. Occasionally, Dave told a crude, sophomoric joke, which always received a larger laugh than it deserved. Colin performed second, and he also liked to mix it up with the crowd. However, Colin composed some excellent material. He delivered clever routines, especially a couple of bits about immigration and border crossings. I ended the show with a half hour or an hour of social commentary and harsh attacks on past and current American presidents. The Edmonton audiences particularly enjoyed a good political slam. I used 3 or 4 audience participation magic tricks to engage the less literate members of the crowd and keep things light and flowing. For the first 2 weeks of the tour, I received resounding ovations, and everything went according to script. All that changed the night we arrived in Moose Jaw. For those of you unfamiliar with the geography of the Great White North, Moose Jaw is a town in the province of Saskatchewan, a couple hundred miles southwest of Edmonton. If they studied the life of Carl Grant in high school history books, that fateful performance on the evening of October 26, 1989 may have been a memorable name given to it by some historian, the Moose Jaw Massacre, Grant's Last Stand, the Heckler's Rebellion, Bury My Heart at Moose Jaw. Picture yourself at the I Don't Get It Comedy Club in Moose Jaw, where they have wire mesh screens to protect the performers from flying objects. And you've got a feel for this particular hell gig, as it's called. As Dave would say, I'm not making this stuff up. From inside the wire cage, the audience appeared to occupy perhaps 36 picnic tables in a large square room. The owners decorated the walls with sports posters and pennants and covered the floor with a couple inches of sawdust. At 6 to 8 per table, the first audience glimpse promised a big crowd, and I looked forward to a successful show. Then Dave walked on stage, and I got my first taste of the character of the audience. Dave always began by yelling at the crowd. The Edmonton and Calgary audiences seemed mildly amused by this behavior, and 3 or 4 members of the audience usually engaged Dave in some friendly banter. When Dave yelled at the Moose Jaw crowd, the place erupted like they were passengers stranded in an airport for 3 days, and Dave had announced another delay. Dave continued to yell, and the audience continued to reciprocate. I couldn't understand a word Dave hollered. Fortunately, the audience didn't drown out Dave's act because he didn't have an act. They screamed at each other for 20 minutes, and Dave introduced Collins and strolled from the stage. Colin seemed to enjoy the crowd's energy. He screamed a few insults and got a couple of laughs. Colin, of course, possessed some real material and tried to introduce it early. The crowd had shouted down his routines and forced Colin to retaliate. Colin didn't seem to mind. After half an hour on stage, Colin managed to sneak in perhaps 5 minutes of his act. If that bothered the guy, he hit it well. Then my ego made an ill-conceived appearance. Well, boys, I thought, that's why God invented headliners. Move over and watch a real pro in action. I'll throw out 5 minutes of my favorite heckler lines, and then these peasants can stand aside because I'm doing my whole act, every delightful syllable. So I entered the wired cage, introduced myself, focused on the loudest, most obnoxious tables, and tossed off a couple heckler lines sure to defuse any situations. Now I know what the first day in San Quentin would be like. This guy's irritating. The Dalai Lama once punched him in the mouth. Pal, I wouldn't spit in your ear if your brain was on fire. And hey, I'm working here. I don't come around when you're working and screw with the Slurpee machine. No one hesitated. No one laughed. No one slowed down. No one seemed to hear a word I said. A few people commented belatedly on my introduction. The comments followed 3 tasteful themes. No one gives a damn about your television appearances. Return to the U.S., you creep. We haven't heard your act, and we don't like it. I trotted out several more heckler lines. No one laughed, and the audience appeared to bristle. I managed to irritate them. A lunatic volunteer torpedoed my attempt at magic. Confused and thoroughly discouraged, I stood in the cage and delivered my act in a drowning, droning voice. 3 comedians stepped onto the stage that evening at the I Don't Get It. Colin and Dave survived their sets with a semblance of dignity and appeared at the bar for their traditional post-performance double shots of tequila. I, the ugly American, did not fare so well. I wandered on stage and died a slow and miserable death. At the time, I blamed the drunken, illiterate rabble of Moose Jaw. Of course, that proved to be an illusion, thanks to William James. The next night in Medicine Hat, most of the audience members belonged to a rugby league. Same wire cage, same sawdust on the floor, same level of audience sophistication and sensitivity. I tried to be more forceful and dynamic. Sure, Carl. While I peppered the crowd with acerbic heckler lines, 2 rival rugby teams formed a scrum. Scrum looks like an American football huddle, except it moves like a malignant human multipede. The serum caromed from the picnic table to picnic table and finally crashed into the wire cage 17 minutes into my act. I know because I consulted my watch as the rugby team members shared a congratulatory moment and crushed beer bottles on their head. 43 minutes left. Have mercy. That night, after the second disastrous show, I lay in bed with a cool washcloth on my forehead. 4 days remained on the Outposts of Civilization tour, and I saw no end in sight and no hope. The thought of going back on stage in any club featuring sawdust and picnic tables brought a sharp stab of terror just behind my eyes. I'd have to cheer up to kill myself. That's when the great American psychologist and philosopher William James arrived in Medicine Hat. Yes, I know, he died in 1910. I can't explain the exact nature of the miracle, but it has something to do with the thousands of hours I spent in reading books. No stranger to dark depression, William James, in his book, blessed the situation with some carefully chosen words. My greatest discovery is discovering how, by controlling your attitude and perceptions, you can control reality and alter your life. At first, I received these words bitterly. Yeah, great. Thanks for the hot tip, Bill. My attitude versus a wire cage and 200 hostile members and the famous Canadian lowbrow culture, what chance did the little gentle attitude have in such an arena? Then I experienced a slow parade of relatively tranquil thoughts. For one thing, I had been myself a feature act for the previous 9 or 10 months, which meant that every week I was traveling someplace with a headliner. Some of those headliners that I got to travel with were world-class comedians. In fact, you'd probably recognize a few of the names, but even a couple that you wouldn't recognize were still exceedingly good comedians. And it finally occurred to me, they got heckled too. Oh, it's part of the job. It's not personal. Now, just this realization changed the way I perceived the situation. Comedians tend to take things so personally, but in fact, it's an ongoing phenomena, and a comedian should simply adapt to the situation. Now, just the knowledge that it wasn't to be taken personally allowed me to relax for the next show and shows after that. And that relaxation is worth the price of admission. It really boosted my ability and kept me from falling to pieces as I normally might have. Another realization, once again, somewhat belated, but the audience supports the show. They are, in a sense, my clients. And my real job is to protect their rights to the best show possible under these circumstances. And that also gave me more of an objective attitude. It gave me a little distance from my own distress, and it allowed me to focus on doing what I could for them. Finally, I watched Colin, who, as I said, was a very good comedian out of Toronto. And Colin had done this kind of thing a lot. And one of the things that I noticed that was different from him was that he just did what he could in half an hour. You see, I was a headliner now, and I had an act that lasted a full hour. And I was really proud of that act. And I wanted to do my act. And the audience wasn't letting me. Now, that put me automatically into a confrontational situation with the audience. Not a good idea, since they're also my clients. Anyhow, Colin, on the other hand, took the view that I got to do half an hour. I get paid the same either way. So if he could get parts of his act in, that was fine. If he could get all his act in, that was great. But most of the time, it was kind of a mixture. He joshed with the crowd and fiddled around and got little bits in at one time or another. But a lot of times, he just kidded with the various hockey players and fraternity guys and whoever was there and did the best he could. And that was maybe not great, but it was way better than what I'd been doing. And so that's another thing that I learned to do. focus on what I could do in that situation. And there I learned to ad-lib, to interact with the audience, to adapt stuff to what they were doing at the moment, and made a tremendous effort. I would focus, of course, at first just on the people, usually a minority, who were there to actually listen to a show. Anyway, I thought again of the words of William James. He didn't say, this is somewhat interesting, why not check our attitude in a difficult situation, could be helpful. He said, the greatest discovery of my life, blah, blah, blah. That's strong stuff. The next evening in Porcupine Plain, I entered the wire cage with an entirely new attitude. First, I decided no matter how the audience reacted, I would not become angry and I would not become discouraged. Second, if my act got lost in the mayhem, so be it. Third, someone's paying me to be funny, and if that's not the greatest job in the world, it's certainly top five. Same picnic table, same sawdust, same audience members who would bring a harmonica to a symphony performance and try to help. As I took the microphone and began to speak, I observed the loud and obnoxious audience. But they no longer seemed to be screaming at me. I enjoyed a sense of inner strength and serenity. Searching the room, I found a picnic table occupied by five or six non-screamers. These people smiled and drank beer, but they did not appear pre-civilization or post-apocalyptic. I made eye contact with a middle-aged, maternal-looking woman at that table. She was pudgy, blonde, and wore a sweatshirt and jeans, and I smiled and wished her a hearty good evening. She raised her beer and smiled back. So I asked, surely night in Porcupine Plain and you and the husband visit the local comedy club with 200 of your close personal friends? Hollering at the guests from out of town, what's your name? Shelley. Thanks so much for the polite response. My name is Carl, and I'm from Seattle. So, when you're not at the comedy club, what do you do? I mean, what did I miss on Friday? I mean, visiting a fast food franchise, counting bovines? What passes for entertainment in Porcupine Plain? Seattle, screamed a heckler from the table next to Shelley's. Seattle's full of Starbucks, Frappuccinos, and bags. Sir, I said, please try to work with the drugs. Several people at Shelley's table laughed. Hecklers around the room raised the volume and the level of venom. At one point, somebody yelled out, you're no good. You're not funny. You are a bum. I leaned forward past the footlights and put my hand over my eyes, just kind of shade them from the glare of the spotlight, and said, Dad? Is that you, Dad? Anyway, this actually got a laugh, and it wasn't the usual type of heckler stopper, but it worked pretty well. Several people at Shelley's table laughed again. You might be surprised if you stayed more than 5 minutes in Porcupine Plain, she explained. We have a library. We have a Unity Church. Shelley, what do you think of the current American president, asked I. I think he's a moron. Well, that's not very nice, Shelley, I said. I mean, he is a moron. You're absolutely correct, but we don't like it pointed out. Sorry, she laughed. I noticed that the people sitting in five or six tables in the center of the room settled down considerably and appeared to be paying attention. Some guy staggered up to the wire cage, screamed something in a garbled voice, and fell to his knees. In a pleasant conversational tone, I gestured at the fallen heckler and speculated, out of 180 million sperm cells, I can't believe this guy was the fastest. The center of the room erupted with laughter. During the rest of the set, I experienced several setbacks. I probably managed to slide in 15 minutes of my one-hour act. However, the simple absence of suffering made it one of my three or four favorite sets ever. On the following nights, I scored two similar victories on the Outposts of Civilization. Before the final scheduled show, Bob, call me Bob, canceled the gig in Foam Lake, and I returned to Alberta one day early. A special deal. You open for John Denver tonight at the Edmonton Performance Hall. Can a rapidly improving attitude create gifts and miracles? Yes and no. Bob refused to part with an extra farthing. I agreed gratefully anyway, because not even William James could improve the attitude of a comedy booking agent. I stepped out on the stage that evening before 3,500 immaculately dressed and coiffed Canadians. These charming and polite people understood all my subtle and political references and jokes. They laughed at every one. Did I mention that Canadians have highbrow tastes and, when gathered, form the most sophisticated and cosmopolitan audiences in America?